This is episode 58 of the Renew the Arts podcast, The Arts and the Evangelical Imagination with Karen Swallow Pryor. Welcome to the Renew the Arts podcast, where we discuss the role of art and creativity in the church and in the world. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. Our motto at Renew the Arts is liberate Christian creativity, and we're doing this through cultivating Christian communities in and through the arts by inspiring art patronage and supporting artists. If you'd like to join our community of monthly donors and contribute to this podcast, please visit renewthearts.org/donate. If you want to join the Porchlight Network and begin your journey into patronage, go to app.porchlight.art and sign up as a host or a tender. I'm here today with Karen Swallow Pryor, an author, professor, and thinker from Virginia, sometimes known as the notorious KSP, a reluctant, sometimes firebrand, and all-around champion of letters, good sense, and I will say all with grace. Thank you, Karen, for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for such a kind introduction.
You're welcome. I've actually been a fan of yours for many years. And consider it an honor and privilege to talk to you today.
Well, we did meet years ago, didn't we, at the Glen workshop.
Yep, at the Glen workshop. Yep,
pre-pandemic days, in the old days.
I remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was excited to meet you then and really happy to talk to you now.
Thank you.
So for our listeners, we invited Karen onto the podcast today to talk about her recent book, The Evangelical Imagination, and how it relates specifically to the arts and the church. And let me say at the start, I understand some of you listening might not have read Karen's most recent book. And so we're going to do our best to keep that in mind and to fill you in as we go along. That said, I actually do very much recommend you read the book. It's well worth your time. So now, all caveats aside, let's just go ahead and jump right in. So the basis of the book, some of the fundamental ideas in the book revolve around this idea of hypocognition. You talk about it pretty early on, referring to unstated assumptions that we kind of operate upon, almost like the water we swim in without any awareness of it as such. This idea is actually throughout the entire book. And I was left wondering if much of the evangelical imaginary is actually hypocognitive in this way, then, and I mean no offense, why write the book? How do you get a person to realize they're operating with assumed and hidden blind spots if they're actually blind even to that blindness?
Oh, let's start with the, you know, the really deep questions, right? yeah, I mean, let me be clear in first saying that this phenomenon of hypocognition is something that is, you know, is we're all subject to, all individuals, all communities. We all exist in social imaginaries. That's the other, tool that I use in the book. And so evangelicals aren't any exception. We all operate this way. We all have these underlying assumptions that we don't even know exist. And, you know, it's very kind of cliche, but I really believe in that expression here that half the battle is knowing the battle, right? Like just being aware that we have things that we're unaware of. And so that we can start asking questions and just simply knowing we might bump up against someone who's using a term in a different way than we are, or we share the same beliefs, but they use different language for it, or they're using different language and we don't even know until further discussion that we actually do share the same belief. We just have a different term for it. I mean, these are things that we encounter all the time just in being human, but when it comes to, you know, whatever our religious beliefs are and our religious community is, it gets a little bit harder because those are usually held so dearly to us. And so, but we just need to be aware that we all have these underlying unexamined assumptions. And when we start to see little glimmers of them, then we can dig a little bit deeper.
And I thought that was really helpful also to distinguish between axioms that are religious axioms and axioms that are cultural axioms. And we've actually blended those categories oftentimes within the evangelical space. And that's not very helpful because we tend to defend some cultural predispositions as if they are religious, as if we can't let go of them, when in fact that's not the case. So I found the book to be really helpful to distinguish between those things. You talk a little bit about how metaphors based on the senses, so like your sensory experience, how they lose meaning and power when they become abstract. Do you think that metaphors can be reinvigorated? And if so, how would you reinvigorate them? Or do they need to kind of be just abandoned and left till they come back into style or something?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, metaphors are a form of language, and language is this way. Language can be fresh, it can be stale, it can be challenging, it can be confining, it can be freeing. And so we have to be, again, aware of that. And so, you know, if we take a metaphor that is very common in evangelicalism, and one that I talk about in the book is born again, mm-hmm. that can be a phrase that is used so much that we actually lose sort of the original freshness and meaning of it, which is very, very powerful mm-hmm. when Jesus says this, right? In the New Testament, you must be born again of water and flesh. I mean, it's radical, it's revolutionary. But then when it becomes a phrase that's so common that it becomes, you know, something that's on, you know, on the headline of a weekly news magazine, and something that a presidential candidate identifies as, and he's dismissed for that, you know, I'm talking mm-hmm. about Jimmy Carter, that's when the phrase really became prevalent in American, modern American culture. It can lose its power. And so it's not necessarily that we should never use it or do away with it entirely, but there may be other metaphors that can just as effectively or more effectively now bring that meaning back. That's why there are different translations or paraphrases of the Bible that, you know, they are paraphrases, but sometimes those paraphrases can liven up and freshen our understanding because we are creatures of language. And this is just how all cliches and jargon phrases work. They can mm-hmm. obstruct meaning. And so we just need to be careful not to allow that to happen, for the real meaning to be stripped away by stale language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it is kind of puzzling when you hear about born again in John, with Nicodemus being almost seemingly daft, because to us, it's like obvious what Jesus is referring right. to. But to right. Nicodemus, he's like, what is this born again you're talking about? Must I re-enter my mother's womb? And he's like, you know, he's out there. So yeah, to get back to that kind of shock and surprise of it, mm-hmm. I don't know, it would be difficult in our time. It's kind of a related question. Do you think, since metaphors are so built on sensory reality, and so much of contemporary life has become disembodied and virtual, do you think that's some of the reason why we're losing that poetic and metaphoric sense in turning so many things into abstractions? And do you have any tips maybe for how to get embodied? Like, do you have practices that help you get back into like your sensory experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the books that I draw upon in my book is a great book called Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. And they, you know, they just sort of take a hike through all of the different categories of metaphors that we use. I mean, basically beginning with the argument that all language is metaphorical, something that we don't really think about, and showing how so much of the words that we now would say are literal are mm-hmm. actually metaphors, and bringing us back to sort of the physical origins of much of the language we use. And, you know, how we get back to a more embodied sense of language is, I think, yes, being intentional about living more embodied lives, whether that means, you know, being outdoors more, or being intentional about talking with people in person rather than always online or through text. And it's something we have to be intentional about. We have to deliberately try to do, and again, think about, so that we can regain some of that awareness of how all language is metaphorical, and how all of our experiences really do begin in our bodily senses. I mean, that's what all aesthetic experience is experience that is processed through our senses, but we've intellectualized everything, and I'm guilty too, and we just think about how we think about things rather than how we perceive them through the senses.
And so what are your favorite get embodied practices?
Well, I do run most days, if you can call it that. It's really hot right now, and I'm getting older and more aches and pains, so you could call it really a gentle jog, I guess. But just being outside in nature every day, you know, that I can, which is most days, that's really important to me. having animals is important to me. They keep me grounded. Mm-hmm. You know, I obviously have to spend a lot of time reading and writing, and I do as much as that I can outdoors in my on my porch or in front of a window if the weather isn't cooperative. I mean, I've chosen a lifestyle that's sort of rural and in the country and involves a lot of being outside. And I know not everyone can do that or wants to do that, but there are ways that we can intentionally create lives where we are paying attention to our sensory experience. Even the music that we listen to, whether it's in the background or whatever our background noise is or the lighting is, to pay attention mm-hmm. to how our bodies respond to the sensory stimuli.
Right. And I mean, I was just thinking about this, but you were hit by a bus not too long ago. I mean, a couple of years ago.
Well, six years ago.
Time
flies today. After you've been hit by a bus. Yeah.
I know, no doubt. Do you feel like even that pain, the lack of comfort there also can remind us of our bodily experience as well? Not that people should go out there and get hit by a bus, but maybe don't waste the suffering that you feel, because you also feel that in your body.
I definitely don't recommend that. But no, it's absolutely true that I've had to become more aware of my body and the position of my body and the furniture that I use and the way that I need to exercise my body. All that is something I'm much more aware of. And even to go back to an earlier part of the conversation, just studying a little bit about trauma, mm-hmm. because I always thought that I understood trauma because I'd read about it and I knew people who had trauma. And so, mm-hmm. of course, I knew about it. But it's an entirely different thing to go through it yourself. And there, of mm-hmm. course, there are different kinds of traumas. This was obviously a very physical one, primarily, along with other, you know, emotional traumas. But I realized through that experience that just reading about something and studying it does not give you the same kind of knowledge that firsthand experience does. I mean, that's so basic, but I learned that. And so again, that's through the body, through my experience, and something that I've been intentional about just sort of receiving and processing and adding to my understanding of the world mm-hmm. and my own unexamined assumptions.
Yeah, no, I that's good. Speaking of born again, going back to previous part, you say that evangelicals in the book, you say that evangelicals tend to emphasize new birth over the new life. Could this be related to the more general emphasis we have on novelty, which you also talk about in the book? For instance, most romantic movies and songs focus on like meet cutes and initial sparks, and far more than they're going to talk mm-hmm. about long-term or ordinary marriage or long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. How do you think this emphasis on dramatic beginnings and conversions affect the Christian arts? And like, what do you think we're missing out on by focusing on that?
Yeah, no, this is a really good question because, you know, evangelicalism, and I am one, just to be clear to everyone listening, but evangelicalism is very much a movement of modernity, beginning as it did in the early 18th century, which I talk about in my book, and really kind of growing up with modernity and the rise of the individual and the Industrial Revolution and all of those things. So evangelicalism inherently emphasizes, as does all of modernity, novelty, mm-hmm. And sort of individualism. And
it's kind of built into the name.
It's built into the name, built into the whole movement. And so, and again, I show the history that evangelicalism was, when it began, was emphasizing the need to be born again for very good reasons, because mm-hmm. it took place in a culture in which there was a state church. And mm-hmm. when there's a state church and you're just considered a Christian by birth, that breeds nominal Christianity, which is not authentic Christianity and mitigates authentic Christianity. And so there was a needed emphasis on being born again. But now we've kind of swung to the other side of the pendulum, and we have this culture, at least in sort of 21st century America, where just being born again is just enough, and we abandon or neglect sanctification and discipleship. Or we so emphasize that momentary novel experience that we feel this need to experience it over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. To go forward again and again, or to recapture that initial, you know, emotional high, a la the romance movies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's not just evangelicalism, it's part of our culture. We're just constantly looking for that emotional high and that newness and freshness because it's part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it at this point sort of blended in with consumerism in a sort of twisted way, because a lot of the things that are new in order to be sellable have to be familiar. And so you end up having this sort of fake newness where it's not really fresh, sort of a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox, trying to gain that same original feeling, but not really taking risks or moving in any direction. And so it's kind of losing that over time as well, which is troublesome. You kind of touched on it a little bit. You distinguish in the book between improvement and sanctification. So sanctification being more like the process of salvation in the life of a Christian. And you talk about the evangelical imagination has an emphasis on improvement, the idea of improvement as a necessary good. How do you think that affects our view of the arts as well? Do the arts promise more in terms of sanctification than they do in terms of improvement? And could that indicate some of the reason why the arts don't seem to have like utility in our evangelical context?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, obviously, everything can be subject to this ethos of improvement. But I think the arts inherently, because they're so centered in our humanity and the human condition and the things that are eternal and transcendent, they're just less susceptible to that kind of utilitarianism or that kind of misunderstanding about what the place that newness has. I mean, and you know, I'm not a visual artist or a musician, so I can't speak knowledgeably about those things, but I do know enough about them to know that the way that a musician learns is by playing the scales over and over, you know, copying and imitating the masters, and the artist draws, you know, tries to recreate other people's drawing in the paintings before developing over long time and skill their own sort of set of skills and experiences that make them an artist. And so the arts are just inherently resist that kind of novelty, but it's still, you know, we still, like the Romantics came along in the late 18th, early 19th century and emphasized uniqueness and creativity. And those things are, of course, are wonderful, but they also tended to dismiss the modes of imitation and what in discipleship really is imitative. And so as I try to show throughout all of the examples I use in the book, none of these things are bad or good in themselves. It's about the excesses. It's about kind of losing the balance and the tension. So yes, we should seek improvement, but we should also not just seek improvement for improvement's sake, just to make it new and improve. And we should seek to be creative and original, but not at the expense of not learning from the masters and finding the worthy models to imitate.
Well, yeah, and that's sort of the problem, I guess, that I'm seeing is you have to have a scale of value for what is improvement. If your improvement is based on, well, we're all wealthier, we feel more comfortable, we have more food and we have to, you know, work less to get it. If that's your idea of improvement, well, then you're not going to have much place for a lot of the arts because they don't necessarily contribute to that. In fact, they might actually undermine it, you know, in some ways.
Hey there, this is Katie Martin, President and CEO of Renew the Arts. We'll get right back to this episode in a moment, but I wanted to sneak in and say thank you for listening to the Renew the Arts podcast. If you are a regular listener and find the conversations on this podcast valuable, I want to ask you to consider making this the year you become a monthly donor. I know Michael has mentioned this opportunity previously, but as a reminder, we have a matching grant available to new monthly donors. Thanks to the commitment of one of our generous board members, any new recurring donations starting at just $10 a month will be matched 100% up to $10,000 for the rest of this year. We have quite a ways to go to take full advantage of this pledge, so please visit renewthearts.org/donate to get started. Thank you in advance for your support. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
I love this sentence from your book because it does touch on this in a sort of oblique way, but you say there's fact, there's fiction, and then there's truth, which transcends both. To arrive at truth requires the work of the imagination. Can you expand on and explain what you mean by that a little bit for the listeners and then maybe talk a little bit about how that relates to the arts?
Mm. Yeah, and of course, this entire book and most of my thinking comes from my study of literature and all the literary history and the genres. And so part of that, the origin of that kind of sentence comes from thinking about that time in literature, which was also not coincidentally when evangelicalism was rising, when there are these new categories of fiction and nonfiction and the kinds of literature that was either one or the other. And that's part, that kind of binary category is, again, another one that defines and characterizes the modern age. Mm-hmm. Is it fact? Is it fiction? Is it true? Is it false? And those are important things. I do care about truth and I do care about falsity. And yet we're experiencing this now. We're experiencing a kind of breakdown of those categories because we have so many competing facts mm-hmm. that we can't even accept sort of the partial picture that one set of facts presents. We have to jettison the whole thing because it doesn't match up with our set of facts. And we're stuck there. And so, but truth accommodates all of it. Truth mm-hmm. accommodates the facts of your experience and my experience and the facts of this study and that study. Somewhere out there, there is, even if we can't see it or grasp it, there is a transcendent truth that accommodates all of our competing versions of what reality is. And now I've kind of lost track of the question, but that I'm just filling it out a little bit more because I think we've just kind of, as little moderns, gotten stuck sometimes with this fact and that fact and your fact and my fact, and we've lost our way. Even if we say we believe in truth, we just lost the way to get there because we're so polarized, and the polarization just leaves us trying to fight each other with our own facts.
Right. Part of the reason I asked the question, because I've run out into this a good bit, is because if you say that truth is fact, that those are basically convertible terms, and Jesus says, your word is truth concerning the scriptures or the word of God. Well, a lot of the word of God is not fact in those terms. It's, you have parables, you have stories, mm-hmm. It's certainly not propositional, and it's not necessarily referring mm-hmm. to, literal factual events. I mean, you look at Book of Revelation, who knows sometimes what it's referring to. A lot of that is mm-hmm. symbolism, story, metaphor, etc. There are pictures, there's art, there's poetry, there's songs. Part of the breakdown, I think, within modernity is that we have these two competing assumptions. One is that truth and fact are convertible terms, and the other mm-hmm. that we should honor and abide by the truth of the scriptures, even though much of the scriptures is not interested in presenting facts as such. And so mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of the confusion that's within the church, especially concerning the arts, where what I've seen over and over again, what do the arts have to offer to the, projection or conception of the facts mm-hmm. when much of the arts is not really interested in presenting that? I mean, as we see mm-hmm. in the scriptures with those stories and the poetry. And so that's sort of the reason I love the sentence so much, is because I feel like you're kind of poking at the problem, that this conflict that's there, that's kind of inherent in our attempt to honor the scriptures. But I mean, I had pastors, I still have pastors, honestly, who will say things like, it's not important to teach the Psalms as songs, it's important to extract their meaning, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just reminded of like Billy Collins' introduction to poetry, where they've strapped the poem down and are beating a confession out of it. It's frustrating to me. And when reading your book, I'm like, okay, you're getting it. You're pointing this out. And in some ways, you're resurrecting the importance of the arts in the truth, because the arts are necessary for the truth, I believe. Anyway, that was sort of the reason for
it. I mean, that's a really important thing to draw out. And even going back to, my area is primarily language and literature. So I'm dealing mainly with words. But the connection there is that, as I said earlier, all language is metaphorical. So it's also just as a painting is a metaphor for something, or a film or music, it's all a different language, right? Mm-hmm. To express our understanding of the world and hopefully to lead us to truth. But they all have that ability to lead or mislead us. But Christians, especially evangelicals within the Protestant tradition, tend to think of words in a different way. And mm-hmm. and there's some basis for that, but that leads us to forget that words are also metaphors.
Maybe fundamentally.
Yeah, absolutely. So we get lost in debates about what's literal and what's not, which is, you know, interesting because, but what do we mean by literal? Because if all language is metaphorical, well, then, you know, it's really just about layers of being literal or metaphorical.
Right. And what you're referring to and how you're attempting to refer to it. I don't want to get into Wittgensteinian conversation here, but yeah, it's a complicated issue that's oftentimes, I think, overly reduced to this simple idea of like truth equals fact. Not helpful. I love it. Love what you have to say. I hope people explore it further. It opens up a lot of worlds. Another question I had for you. So redemption stories, even though there's an emphasis in evangelical art on redemption stories, and you see them, you know, a lot of movies and songs are basically just, you know, altar calls of some kind or another. But they're really hard to tell, as you say in the book, without becoming sentimental, performative, or cheesy. What are your favorite redemption stories? I wanted to ask you. You mentioned Christmas Carol and Pilgrim's Progress, so those are off the table. You have to give me new ones. And but I'm also, what do you think Christian artists, if you have any tips, what do you think they should keep in mind in order to create better, more compelling redemption or conversion stories?
Yeah, well, so when I mentioned in the book A Christmas Carol and The Pilgrim's Progress, those are like classic examples of redemption stories. And they're also sort of the most literal, to go back to that word. And so they're ones that, you know, as a culture, we tend to love and to know, whether, you know, whatever, even if it's only the Muppet version or whatever. And so they show us how important redemption is. For my personal favorites, I really do, you know, I like richer, more complicated versions of redemption story. That's sort of part of my answer to the second part of this question is, you know, what can artists do? Is I do think things that are complicated are truer to human experience in life and therefore are more helpful. One of my favorite redemption stories, I mean, there are just so many, but the first one that popped into my mind was Terrence Malick's film, The Tree of Life. I just love that film and love the vision of redemption that it offers, as complicated and messy as it is. So that's the first example that comes to mind. You know, I just, this is really off the cuff, but I just finished listening on Audible to Stephen King's latest collection of short stories. I do love Stephen King. You know, he's horror, and but he's a great writer. And so and he's reaching the end of his life. Some people are talking about whether he's approaching this collection as though it might be his last one. So the last story in that recent collection is called The Answer Man. It's a great horror story, but the ending is like so powerful and redemptive and was unexpected that I was just really moved by it. And I wasn't expecting that. So these two different examples, I hope, just show that different kinds of art, different genres, different ways of doing it can show redemption in very different and powerful ways. But again, I think the complication and the richness is important. I keep struggling. I don't even know if I should bring this up, but I'll just go ahead and bring it up. I keep struggling with evangelicals' obsession with fantasy, because I do think, and I'm, you know, I do think fantasy tends toward the sentimental, tends toward sort of the black and white and the less nuanced portrayals of experience. And I think that the close connection of evangelicalism in the past century or so with fantasy is bearing some fruit, I think, in our lesser ability to nuance and to sort of deal with the rough edges and the layers and the complications of political life, for example, and each other and church life. So I'm all for the sort of nuanced, complicated approaches to redemption. But with that in mind, I'm also a teacher at heart. So I understand that we have to meet people where they are, and not every audience is ready for, you know, Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man Is Hard to Find. You know, when I would teach that to my freshmen, I learned over the years, I had to prepare them for it, even though I think it's one of the greatest works of art, at least in short story form out there. And so again, there are tensions we have to hold.
Yeah. And even touching, kind of connecting to what you were just saying, if fast, cheap entertainment, amusement, fantasy, escapism, all these kinds of things have actually deformed our souls, like shaped us into the kinds of people who like those kinds of things more and more and more. to the point where we don't even have the capacity to appreciate genuine, complex, beautiful things like you're talking about. What does that mean for artists? Do they need to self-limit almost in order to accommodate the limitations of their audience? Like perhaps most audiences aren't going to go straight from Big Macs to fine dining. So how do you deal with that? Because at the same time, you can lament the loss of good art and complex art. If there's not an audience for it, how can artists make it? Because they can't even support themselves doing it. And so like, what's the solution there?
Yeah, wow, big questions here. Well, first of all, there is no one-size-fits-all solution for all artists. And I will say, because I just turned in the manuscript for my next books, so this is where my brain and heart have been lately. Yeah. It has almost everything to do with calling. So, you know, different artists are going to be called to different things and have different audiences and have different roles. That's a different question altogether. But I do think, you know, you have people in front of you, you start there trying to reach them in whatever your art is, and you try to bring them along and maybe nurture their sensibilities and their tastes and cultivate their tastes. We're all called to different times and places, and we have different skill sets and different abilities, but also different audiences. And so leaning into our own calling is central, and understanding we can't do it all. And, you know, I consider myself my own work. I don't consider myself to be a great artist or thinker. I consider myself to be kind of a translator, translating, you know, certain ideas and concepts for an audience, you know, usually of evangelicals. And so that's been my calling. And so I'm not creating great works of philosophy a la Charles Taylor, but hopefully I'm translating some of his work for my audience.
And that's really important. I mean, I think artists need advocates like that because of this disconnect between most artists in what they're capable of doing and then in what their audiences are capable of receiving. They kind of need a bridge. And so I do appreciate very much your advocacy and your bridge making between them, because I think that most artists don't even realize how much they need it, and they're just frustrated a lot of times. So in the book, there are two really big lobes of thought that you have. One has to do with the evangelical movement towards power and the connections that power and the temptations of power. But the other one, which almost seems at odds with it, which is really interesting, is this idea of fantasy escapism or sentimentality. That evangelicals have both an obsession with power and an obsession with sentimentality. They're kind of dupes to both, which is a very weird, I mean, it's apparently true, but it's so weird because you'd think sentimentality and power would just be on totally opposite sides of the spectrum. But I think you make a really good case in the book that they're connected. And you even talk about what I thought was a really weird phrase in the book called sentimental authority. And I was hoping that you would expand on that and explain that a little bit more. How does sentimentalism become like almost an avenue toward power?
When I write books like this, I'm researching and learning for myself. I'm interested in these things. So I'm, you know, trying to figure it out. And then I write the book and I'm like, oh, now I think I understand it better. I should go back and rewrite the book. So, which I can't do. All that to say, I've been continuing to think about these things more and more in the, you know, almost year or so since the book has been out, and make more, hopefully make more connections that, and I'm glad you see the connections in the book, because I feel like I could make them more clearly now. So yes, you're right. It seems like they're at odds, this desire for power, even if it's, you know, benevolent power, and this tendency towards sentimentalism. But what connects them is a tendency toward fantasy, but what connects them is sentimentalism, right? Because we have sentimental views of power and authority, which is different from sentiment. I'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, I wrote a piece a few weeks ago for The Dispatch where I talk about this movement toward Christian nationalism, which I see as rooted in sentimentality. Like, I mean, there are people literally calling for a Christian prince. And I'm like, have you been watching too many cartoons? Because, you know, there are people who really think that that is the answer. And I'm thinking their souls have been formed by cartoons and fantasies because, and not by history.
And nostalgia. For a past that never existed.
Yes, exactly. And that's sentimental. And so when I talk about sentimental authority, I mean, that's an example of how sentimentality can have an authority over us because it just seems easier. If we know who the good guys are and the bad guys are, if we could put the white hats, cowboy hats on some and the black cowboy hats on the other, or the you know, Star Wars is the same. I don't know what those mm-hmm. uniforms are called, but the storm, I don't even know. But yeah, there are white ones and black ones. Right?
The red sabers versus the green and blue sabers, right?
Yes, there you go. So there's that. But even in the church itself, this is the part of the book I think you're quoting from, where I talk about how even within evangelicalism, like, we don't have popes and you know, and ornamental vestments, mm-hmm. but that give us authority. But if a preacher with, you know, skinny jeans and a cool shirt and cool haircut stands up in front of us and acts like he's our buddy, that also can wield a kind of authority over us. That sort of impression of familiarity and casualness that can make us just as susceptible to that kind of person's misused authority as the one with the, you know, pointed hat and the fancy robes.
Right. And this maybe connects to what we were talking about as far as art's utility. One of the most powerful utilities of art, which has been exploited in propaganda for a really long time, is that it is persuasive, that it is useful for mm-hmm. persuasion. And you quoted a little bit of William Blake's Marginalia, where he writes, "Empire follows art, not the other mm-hmm. way around." And we've used a quotation on this podcast that politics is downstream from culture. And we've talked about that quite a bit. And considering most people don't really believe that, or at least they say they don't, what are some ways we can extricate the arts from being yet another tool of utility in this coercive and often even imperial mm-hmm. culture war?
Yeah, now again, I'm going to answer more as an audience okay. for art as opposed to an artist. And, you know, I guess there are artists out there trying to use art in that utilitarian way and, you know, don't. But it's more, you know, speaking more for the audience of art or the consumers, for lack of a better word, we have to be careful that we aren't using art that way. Well, you know, I'll quote C.S. Lewis here, you know, in Experiment and Criticism, where he talks about literature is to be received, not used. Mm. I think a lot of us as audience members, whether it's readers or viewers or listeners, we want to use art. We want to use it to reaffirm our worldview or to convince others. And mm-hmm. that's why we avoid art that is just so sort of perplexing mm-hmm. and challenging, mm-hmm. That makes us uncomfortable, because we just want it to reaffirm us. And so it is the responsibility of both the artist and the audience, I think, to really just let art do what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Which is to reflect the human condition in all its complexity. And that's a lot. That's not really narrowing it down, but that's what art does, is it reflects human experience and the human condition. And it doesn't have to provide an answer, but it can point us to truth. I mean, it's really not reflecting the human condition if it doesn't point us to truth, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get deeper into this issue of sentimentality, because this is there's a large portion of the book that talks about sensibility and its transmogrification into sentimentality over time. You call it, you say that sentimentality is, quote, an emotion in excess of what the situation demands, emotion for its own sake and as a value in itself, as opposed to emotion for a purpose or goal beyond itself. And you even quoted from Milan Kundera, where he talks about how sentimentality is the crying of two tears, one tear for the, you know, emotionally moving scene, and the other tear that you are joined in with the crying of over this emotion. So it's almost like an emotion concerning the emotion. And that a lot of people, I mean, you know, like, I have teenage daughters, and, you know, when they were a little bit younger, even than they are now, and they're only 16, they used to stare in the mirror and cry. And at a certain point in the crying in front of the mirror, they would start to cry about the crying, and they'd be having a very overwhelming emotional experience. And it was like this inwardly turned empathy. And, you know, I recommended they not do that, like turn yourself outward. But this idea that you have in there, and you do talk about it, but you don't really explore it in the book as much. And I'm really curious. You say that emotion has a purpose or goal beyond itself. What is the purpose or goal of emotion, and how can art cultivate it?
This is the nuanced point that I want to in the book and now to make clear that emotions are not bad, right? I mean, because mm-hmm. we've got a whole, you know, segment of Protestant Christianity out there that kind of elevates reason over emotion. Well, mm-hmm. that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying emotions are bad, but indulging in emotions for the sake of emotion is just as distorted as having a purely rationalistic or materialistic approach to anything. So those mm-hmm. are two extremes. Yeah. And so what are the purposes of emotion? I mean, again, we go back to the body, because emotions, you know, the literal sort of etymology of the word emotion is like a moving out from the body, like there's a stirring in the body. Mm-hmm. And so because we are embodied creatures, our emotions are important. They tell us something. Mm-hmm. So whatever it is that they are telling us, we should listen to it. Doesn't mean that what they are telling us is a completely accurate reflection of reality, but it's a completely mm-hmm. accurate reflection of what's going on inside our bodies and spirits at that time that needs to be listened to. Mm-hmm. So there is a purpose there for them. All the more reason, it's so important and so valuable, all the more reason not to like to try to distort it ourselves. You know, we're talking about pure emotion here, but then going back to, you know, some of the examples that we might, like the examples you brought up, you know, crying is perfectly fine, but crying because we're crying is again, that's that simulacrum that you talked about before, the Xerox of the Xerox of the Xerox, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the further away we get from reality and from ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Kind of piggybacking on that. And again, this was in passing and I wanted more. So if you ever do a second okay. edition, right. I wanted a little more on this. You mentioned again in passing that Aristotle and Sir Philip Sidney both argue, and you say rightly, you do say rightly, that good art can train the emotions toward virtue. And so maybe that's one of the things beyond the emotion itself that affections are designed to do. This goes back even to like Aquinas, who was a big fan of Aristotle, as you probably know. He talks about anger as the energy necessary to accomplish justice. And so it's not the anger itself that's being pursued, that anger is a thing that is supposed to give you the energy necessary to do this other thing that needs to be done, this to make things right. But how do you think that good art actually does train the emotion towards that virtue, towards virtuous behavior?
Well, so shout out to myself. I do cover this much more extensively in my previous book on reading well, Finding the Good Life, the great book. So yeah. Okay. So that
so
might
you didn't
be why
need
I
to
mentioned
say.
It.
Okay.
So it's my fault. I didn't read that. But that's actually what, you know, what virtue ethics is studying sort of, well, part of it is it, in literature is the study of how literature and art can train the emotions to be in proper proportion, to be virtuous rather than vicious. And so I do talk more about Aristotle and Sidney in that book. You know, basically they both argue in their own way that that literature or art sort of stimulates emotions in response to whatever is being portrayed and allows us to sort of exercise those emotions vicariously. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing something that's not real, but it's raising in us emotions that are real, that mm-hmm. feel the same as they would if we were in that situation. And so we are exercising or practicing the use of those emotions in a vicarious way.
Mm. But if the art is only for the purpose of the pleasure or even the emotional experience for its own sake, and if it's disconnected from the truth because it's non-factual and it's in this fantasy world, right. It's like you're really disconnecting it from any right. true purpose it could have.
But you could be mistraining or malforming exactly. the emotions, right? Exactly. So that's
and
why it needs to be good art. Yeah, good art.
Yeah, so we're going to get into this then, because again, you make this, I think, amazing and very accurate claim that Thomas Kincaid paintings have a lot to in common with pornography. And, you know, I hope that's as shocking as it should be for our listeners, because I think you have a really good case in this. You explore it a little bit in the book. What's interesting is that my friends and I, we have this thread. I have a like 8 guy friends. We have this man thread where we talk about man things. And
like Thomas Kincaid.
Yes, like Thomas Kincaid, right. But we actually had a conversation before I read your book that we said Kincaid paintings are like pornography. And the reason we said they were similar is because they give the pleasure of a simulated destination without strengthening or preparing you for the journey you would have to take in order to get to that destination in reality. So that was like our kind of conclusion at the end, is that it doesn't strengthen you to get there. It just pretends that you're already there.
You should have, I should have quoted you in the book. That's perfect. I mean, and in all honesty, in that part of the book, I'm just echoing Flannery O'Connor, right? Because she makes, I mean, she just, when I, you know, however many years ago I read this first in Mystery and Manners, where she talks about sentimentality and obscenity or pornography being the same, because they're, you know, they're trying to achieve the aim without the purpose, right? That's another way of putting it. It's you know, emotion stripped of its purpose, sex stripped of its purpose, the nostalgia of a Kincaid painting stripped of its purpose. I mean, nostalgia for nostalgia's sake is just another use of emotion without purpose.
And again, I mean, he's talking about like a heavenly, quote unquote, heavenly reality. But again, there, the idea of heaven in his paintings are so deeply fantastical, where it's like, I hope heaven's actually not like that, to be totally frank. I you know what I mean? I hope it's a little more gritty than that. I hope the blades of grass really do cut my feet, you know? I really loved that connection, and I also felt vindicated, so I thought I should bring it up.
No, that's amazing. That's great. I'm so glad. And I would definitely, whatever essay it is, I can't remember the title, in Mystery and Manners, anyone who's interested in this idea should definitely read O'Connor.
Yeah, and you also talk about the sentimentality trap article that was in First Things. I can't remember who wrote that, but you mentioned that in the book as well, which is also a really good article. I'll link to those things in the show notes. So I want to talk about this as well, and this will be our last doodad. I have a little bit of a theory that sentimentality isn't actually an overemphasis on emotions. I actually think that in some ways, and this would relate the sentimentality power dynamic, I actually think it's a cheap and shallow counterfeit version of real sensibility, and that it in some ways is because of an undervaluation of emotions in a power-hungry and rationalistic and materialistic culture, that in some ways it's become deformed, small, tiny, silly, and shallow because of that. Not because of an overemphasis, but an underemphasis. Do you have any thoughts on that?
My initial thoughts are that sounds exactly right. You know, where I tend to see sentimentality is in pockets where is sort of genuine, true emotional responses to real life situations are lacking. And so it's almost like a projection, I don't know if that's the right word or an exaggeration. You know, I mean, I guess like sentimentality is, you know, is to emotions what passive aggressiveness is to poor leaders or something. It's a result of an under exercise of its proper use and form. Now make the connection again, because I really find it interesting and provocative to power. Make that connection again.
Because people who value power, the utility of power and getting things done, and who also are rationalistic or materialistic or factually oriented, like factualist in their approach to truth, tend to see absolutely no purpose or value in the cultivation of emotion.
Or empathy. And you see those arguments being made all the time. Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And they because it's sentimentality or even just affection. Affections are viewed as a weakness and a vulnerability to those who seek power. And but sentimentality removes the vulnerability. It removes the weakness. It makes it safe. It makes it caged. It imprisons it. And it almost siphons it off into its own tiny little place where we can still have the pleasure of emotion without any usefulness or any vulnerability or any undermining that affections do actually have, like empathy. You know, if you're wanting to dominate another person, feeling empathetic for their position or understanding where they're coming from is a really dangerous thing to do. Like, that's not what you want to do. They need to be monsters. They need to be orcs. They can't be human beings, you know. And I see that on both sides. I mean, honestly, I'm a equal opportunity denouncer as far as these things are concerned, because I honestly do believe that these things are on both sides of most arguments. There's a lot of a mischaracterization of others in the kind of politically polarized, as you said, environment that we currently are in. At the same time, there is this sort of unbridled affection for this, or emotion for the sake of emotion's sake, but almost because it's not allowed to do anything other than that.
Right.
that it is cordoned off to this one little place of, you know, its only utility, which is pleasure and escapist relief, and perhaps the, you know, propagandistic caricatures of our enemies and of ourselves, you know. So I don't, because I mean, again, this is the case with all the arts. I find it hilarious how I'm insulted by most Christian music. I'm insulted by most Christian movies. I'm like, is this really what you think I want? Is this really who you think I am? But then I go and I listen to hip hop or country music or any of these things. And I'm like, it's the same thing. You have somebody who doesn't even have a country accent going, you know, red dirt girl in the pickup truck with the Budweiser in the bud book, you know, and you're just like, what is going on? Like, this person is from Australia, you know, like, and people are buying it. Like, aren't they insulted?
No, I think these are amazing insights. And I think it's not coincidence that, you know, that this is getting even worse in the age of AI, because, I mean, AI isn't just artificial intelligence. I think it's also contributing to this artificial emotional intelligence, right?
Correct.
Which is why its art is so bad. It's it's not just bad because it's artificial, obviously, but it's also, it just tends to be this kind of parody, you know. That's why there's a lot of political art that is created by AI that reinforces the existing tropes and amplifies them. Yeah, I think there is this direct connection between under-exercised, malformed emotions and the use and misuse of power, and they both reinforce each other.
Yeah, and create just the most derivative art that has ever been. Again, Xeroxes, Xeroxes, familiarity, safety, it's all safe. It's all extremely, extremely safe. Anyway, so I want our listeners, if I may say this just for a moment, to be bold in this. You know, like, listen boldly, freely, understand the real true value of affections and emotions. I hope that this conversation has helped somewhat with that. I love you, Karen. You're great. I'm so glad that you're out there doing the work that you're doing. And I really appreciated your book as well. I
thank you. I can tell your questions. You were one of the best readers. So thank you. Thank you for that honor.
Well, you're welcome. That is an honor to me to say. Do you have anything to leave us with, or how can we find out more about your next book, and where should our listeners follow you and things like that?
Yeah, well, I have a basic website, karenswallowpryor.com, where you can get basic information about my books and my speaking engagements. I'm on Twitter or X way too much, so you can find me there. I'm trying to, but where I really would love you to find me is my Substack newsletter, which is called The Priory. And I write about, you know, a few different things, but I'm mainly just studying, you know, kind of taking a survey through British literature, as though I were teaching a British literature survey class. So it's free for everyone. So find me on Substack at The Priory, and love to have you join along.
Excellent. And do you have any words, final words of wisdom? Give us a charge, any charges for us?
Oh, let's see. Oh, I didn't know I was going to get that chance. I would just, again, I'm speaking more as someone who appreciates art as opposed to creating art. And so I will speak to readers and listeners and hearers to just, you know, to read widely and well, whether, you know, it's literally or metaphorically, to expand your taste, to talk to other people about art you don't understand, and try to learn and appreciate, and don't be afraid of the complexities and the challenges, whether you're the maker or the receiver of the art.
Very good. I hope you really do take that to heart, my dear listeners. And thank you so much, Karen, for being with us today. Really appreciate it. It was great to talk to you. I love your books, and I'll continue to read your next one as it comes out. I'm excited about it. And and I'll link to all your things in the show notes. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
In this episode, Karen and I talked about the tendency of contemporary art to focus on fresh beginnings and the initial spark of romance or conversion. So, to end this episode, I wanted to play a track from a record that celebrates married relationship in the long term. This is Don't I Know, from the record All the Days by Physic. It tells the story of a morning in the life of a married couple long into their relationship, and the gratitude they feel in the security of their shared love. I hope it blesses you.
get up, shuffle out, pour some coffee, you've already been up and out, taking care of everything. I look up, see your face, there's a smile, body turning in expectancy.
How do you sleep?
Trying to share a hug.
There's a plate on the table if you want to.
I approach,
do
set
you
my
want egg
on the table, and is this really happening?
You okay?
How
you
did you learn to eat?
Missed you last night, it's chilly in the bed.
Heart aches and breaks.
In death.